to Listen to Older Voices, a program produced for Uniting Melba and podcast through the Toorak Times. It's always a pleasure to bring you through their stories, life and times of older people in our community. All very interesting, all very different, and all very entertaining. This is a special Baby Boomers edition. Greetings and welcome to the award-winning program of Listen to Older Voices. This is the third and final program featuring the life and times of Judy Donnelly. Over the past two programs, we've learned that Judy was born in the Baby Boomer generation in 1952 and was brought up in Hamilton, which is not far from the major Canadian city of Toronto. Coming from a family that embraced music, it was no wonder that while at university in the 1970s, Judy left her course to become a professional singer with a band when the opportunity presented itself. However, it was in the world of providing her voice for jingles and ads that she really made some money. This week we learn how music came to assist her connect with the young Australian musician Sam C, who joined her band in Canada. He and Judy hit it off, but he had to go back to Australia, and maintaining a long-distance relationship over several decades simply didn't work. So we discover how they did reconnect and how Judy eventually migrated to Australia and is now happily residing in Belgrave, Victoria with Sam in a relationship which some might say was meant to be. But there's much, much more to this story, so let's make a start. Here's Judy explaining how this Australian part of her life came to be. How does a musically inclined academic researcher in Canada find herself sitting in her dining room in Belgrave,
right,
Australia? That's a huge jump.
It is. Well, I mentioned I've talked a lot about this band I was in with my now good friend Carla in the early 70s. And the band went through a lot of personnel changes. And in 1975, we were looking for guitar player and bass player, and I think a drummer too, probably. Anyway, to make the short of it is, this Australian guy showed up and he came and heard the band and liked us, and then came and met us. We were playing up in this town in Northern Ontario, so he got on the bus and came up there, and everybody just hit it off immediately with him. His name was Sam C. And we can't actually remember how he heard about the band. There was some tenuous connections, but we don't actually know. And there was just this moment, probably 2 days after we had met, where I was standing in the bar playing, talking to him and just looking at this guy and thinking, wow, this guy is really, really special. Really like this guy a lot. As it turned out, when we did start a relationship, it wasn't the right time for that relationship for various reasons. So we kept in touch, but, you know, and he came back to Australia a few years after that. And it was very hard. We did try and stay in touch, but, you know, life had moved on.
Yes.
And back then it was, you know, it would take 3 weeks for a letter,
right.
And you never would phone, my God.
Oh, God,
no. You couldn't phone. That was crazy. And so life went on, and, you know, various relationships, children and so forth.
And you find yourself in this academic world.
And I'm in the academic world then, and really loving it. I had gone back to singing with Carla. We had an a cappella group in Toronto with two other women for about 10 years, mostly just for fun, but we worked quite hard at it. And so that was always, it was nice to have music back in my life like that too. And so I can't think of how long, probably about 18 years or so ago, out of the blue, I got a phone call from Sam. He had tried to find me on the internet. They put the phone books out on the internet at that point. And I'll make a very long story short here, but we resumed our relationship. Very long distance, obviously. And I came over here for the first time in 2000.
But just for a visit?
For a visit, sort of test the waters. And absolutely loved it here. I knew I would love it here, but not knowing what the future would hold for us, I thought I need to think about you know, could I actually move here? This is, you know.
Because you don't seem to be a person that makes rash decisions. You seem to be a person that thinks things through.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, this went on for a number of years.
But you made the move and you arrived here in 2010. What were your first impressions?
Well, I came in the wintertime. You and I are speaking right now in July.
Winter, yeah.
And my first visit here was in July. So it wasn't like walking into a 42-degree Uluru day or anything.
Yes, yes.
It was familiar somehow. And many people I've spoken to think there's a lot of similarities between Toronto and Melbourne. You know, both waterfront places, slightly edgy, a lot of wonderful cultural mix. Hamilton, where I'm from, and Toronto, huge Italian communities, great communities in Toronto. So that sort of cultural, like very, it felt very, very comfortable, I must
say. If you'd arrived 40 years beforehand, it would have been different, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Sam talks about that a lot, about leaving when he left Melbourne. It was, you know, it was very backwards, but old-fashioned.
It was
from when he came back, you know, in the late 70s, it had
so
been able to grow
up. So you were comfortable with the country?
Absolutely comfortable, yeah. Felt right at home. There are a lot of cultural similarities, of course, like the Commonwealth thing, although Canada's influences are so much more American, or at least...
Oh, for obvious reasons.
Yeah, obvious reasons. And then, of course, Canada's got the French as well, which is enormously important, I think. It really informs the whole country and very important to me personally. But yeah, it felt really comfortable. And the more times I came over here, I thought, and of course I had this built-in friendship group, Sam's friends, who were lovely people.
Of course.
Lovely
people.
That makes
it easier.
And through my academic work, I'd also, in fact, made a couple of connections with Australian academics that were working in the same field I was. And so I'd go and visit them when I came here as well.
Was it relatively easy, or was there a difficulty in leaving people like Carla behind and the people that you connected with?
It was enormously difficult. By the time I moved here, I was in my late 50s. So but it was, I absolutely had the support of everybody who loved me and everybody I loved. And I knew it was the right thing to do. So it was enormously hard. It's still very hard being that far away from people I spent most of my life with. But it's a lot easier to stay in touch with people now than it would have been 20 or 30 years ago. And also I have made, you know, the friends I have here now have been my friends for nearly 20 years, many of them.
Of course. And that's a generation, isn't it?
It is.
So it's a meaningful period.
Yeah, and you know, you and I are talking now, and we've shared many of the same experiences growing up. Our age group has shared those experiences growing up in different sides of the world. And so you can connect kind of, not automatically, but there is that connection with people. Yeah. And I think luckily for me, I inherited my mom's ability and desire to be collegial and to make friends and to sort of go with the flow and everything.
And you have a curious mind, so
definitely
coming to a new country would also partly feed that curiosity to research and discover.
Absolutely, and my work today is as an archivist and historian. And I was saying to one of my kind of cousins in Canada, who's become our kind of family historian, I said, I feel this, it's like this hunger for history, this hunger for knowledge now that you sort of wish you'd had when you were at uni in your 20s, which I did have when I went back to school because I really appreciated that aspect of it more.
But when you went back, you were a little bit more mature, weren't you?
Exactly,
and that makes
a
big difference.
But now, like, I want to know, what is that building and who built it? And that's my job, of course, at where I work.
Listen to Older Voices, where you hear stories from older people who chose to make Australia their home. So what is your job and where do you work?
I'm the archivist at Methodist Ladies College, which in Melbourne, which is 136-year-old girls' school. And I'm absolutely passionate about women's history and girls' history in particular, because it's the history of children is so undocumented. because they didn't really have, you know, a role in society. So I love that in our, we have records going right back to the school's founding in 1882, and you can follow the threads of girls' education through those decades. And some of the work I do is giving information to families. So there, we have the stories of parts of their grandmother or great-grandmother's lives that they know nothing about. And we've got those to varying degrees of detail in our records. And you know, in like we have very, very strict privacy records, obviously, about who we release information to. But it's a very satisfying part of the work there. I've mostly worked in educational institutions all my academic life, if I can use the word academic. And I love the energy of being around younger people and students and the cycle of the year. And there are over 2,000 students at MLC. And I get to work, I do some teaching, so I'm in touch with the young, the year two students, right up to the year 12 students. So it's a fabulous job.
Oh, you've awoken a lot of questions in my head. So I'll try and go back to the first ones and come up to this. Now, taking into account the issue of privacy, so we're not trying to talk about specific people.
Yeah.
But have you come across what you would think of as remarkable or very interesting stories in researching the history of the people?
Oh, absolutely. I got the chance. One of the things that I've been able to do at the school and introduce there is having a large, large exhibition once a year that's based on an archival topic or, you know, an anniversary. And in 2015, of course, was the Anzac centenary. Mm-hmm. And, of course, for me coming from Canada, I've had to learn all about Australia's, the wars from the Australian perspective, which are a lot of similarities, but very different as well from the Canadian perspective. One of the things that we had at the school was an honor board that was done in 1918, and it had the names of 21 old collegians, as we call them, these women that had gone to the school and had nursed at the front in the war. And so they were the focus of this exhibition that I did. So I got to research these women who had incredibly diverse roles, nursing all over any place where there were soldiers in the war. So, you know, in Egypt and then moving to France and in England in the rehab hospitals, on the hospital ships. So, you know, there's not a specific person. But it just opened my eyes so much. And a lot of these records are now available through the War Memorial and National Archives of Australia. And you can follow the particular woman's story through. There's some pretty good recently written books by scholars looking at what these women did, and their roles were largely been unrecognized. And they're working in horrific conditions, in the mud, in the snow, in the desert, treating war injuries and dysentery, and they're wearing, you know, these long bloody woolen skirts and extraordinary devotion. So their stories really stick with me, and I've done quite a bit of work on their lives since then, and that's absolutely fascinated me.
It's fascinating, really important, isn't it? Because, I mean, without wanting to take away the experiences and the contribution men made during these things, the women's stories are largely untold.
Exactly.
And unrecognized.
That's right. And they suffered as much as did the men after the war in terms of trauma, and a lot of them never got any kind of pension at all.
Oh, and they were not recognized in the RSL either.
That's right. I mean, they are now. Their names are on a lot of the war memorials, including our little one in our neighborhood.
But not when they came back.
Yeah, that's
which is
right.
When they needed it.
Yeah, and you know, many of them single women who had no way to support themselves. Mm. You know, so really powerful stories. So they really stick with me, though, and I've maintained my interest in researching their lives, because more and more since the centenary in 2015, a lot more information keeps being added to the War Memorial website and stuff, and you can piece together these little bits about their lives. So, and it's a real honor to have done that kind of research and make a little contribution towards the Australian scholarship on this topic.
Well, I think by the sounds of it, you've filled an incredible void that's been there in terms of our knowledge.
Well, I think I've been able to supply some information, as I mentioned earlier. This part of their lives when they're at the school would not have been largely known to outside researchers other than, oh, we think this person went to MLC in this year. I said, oh, well, yeah, she did, and she won this prize, and her sister was here, and, oh, she was living with this person then, and
almost,
so
like,
forth.
Almost like little just dot points in history rather than stories. It's just an annotation in history rather than anything else.
Yeah, but it's nice to connect our little bits of information with these larger stories.
Well, that's what's happening now because of the – I can only imagine that as you find this stuff and publish it out, others pick it up and follow it through even in more detail.
Exactly.
Roads.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's great because in many instances there's no – you know, descendants can't be found and so forth. So – and where they are found, they're again happy to have these bits of information added to their relatives' story. So,
without wanting to make too much of a point on your – stroke our age, we are in the age group which a lot of other people now look at as older people. We're well into our 60s, some of us are into our 70s. The image that's been carried through most generations is that when you get into that age group, you're finished. You're an old person. You're supposed to go and just be ignored. Your life is anything but over, is it? You are still so very active.
Absolutely, yeah.
Is it important to, do you think that the, particularly when I say younger, I'm talking about people that haven't reached our age group yet, recognise that hitting 60, hitting 70, your life doesn't end?
Absolutely. And I think we've benefited from the enormous changes since our parents were, say, our parents were the generation where you turn 65 and that's it. You weren't allowed to work after that. And we have, I think that is still a vision that persists a little bit, but we've defied that, I think. And I think it's not surprising. It's part of our generation of growing up and trying to push the boundaries. I think all through our lives we've tried to do that. And I think also because being involved in the arts and the music scene in particular, it's quite clear that that music scene, maybe we can thank Keith Richards and Mick Jagger, but it's clear that you can just keep on going, you know. And as our friends Sam and Glenn say, not ready to roll over yet. Well,
no.
Nobody's coming and saying, here's your gold watch, you have to stop now. Okay, well, let's just keep going, to hell with that. And that, you know, and this having this community of people our age who are still have all these different interests and many of whom are still working. Like I always think of Normie Rose, drummer Trotter, who's now... He must be 77 now and just got a new drum kit a few years ago. And he's still playing. And there's no... And how old is Ringo Starr, you know?
And nobody thinks twice about it, do they?
Not
you don't,
really.
You don't go, oh, I'm not going. See, a 77-year-old drummer, you don't think of it like that.
No, you just think, oh, this is great. And everyone's not sort of sitting around. And there, again, there's this... I've talked about, for me, this hunger for history and hunger for knowledge. I think for our generation... There's this hunger for music still, and that never really goes away, but it's turned into a, you know, like we want to hear live music, and so we're going to go out and hear it, and there are opportunities to hear it, and it's lovely that there are still so many musicians that are our age who are performing, and at the peak of their performance abilities, I would say, for many of them.
Oh, definitely.
And then, you know, extending out from that, there's just so, like where I live in the Dandenong Ranges, I've gotten involved with our local land care group because that's, you know, growing up in our generation that was the first generation that really had to be concerned about the environment. And there's a lot of incredible landscape around where I live. So I love going out on weeding or planting plants and learning about what is growing around me and what's endangering the trees and the things that I love. And there's a lot of different opportunities within those groups to do whatever you want to do. So that's something that I hope to get more involved in, is maybe starting to reduce my other workload.
We are lucky enough to live up here in the hills. But looking broader, do you have concerns for what's happening environmentally?
Oh, absolutely.
And what is it that mostly concerns you?
You know, there's no question about global warming, and my friends in Canada have just been experiencing temperatures in the low 40s and high humidity, which is pretty unusual for where they live. and just the destruction of animal habitat throughout the world. You know, coming from Canada, of course, you've got the image in your mind of the polar bear on this tiny, not tiny, but this small piece of ice, and the permafrost in the north melting, and horrific implications for the planet. I don't think you can't grow up in that, you know, our lifetime without being concerned for the environment. You can't live in a place like the Dandenong Ranges and not realize, like, the reason we're living here is because it's so beautiful and we love the forests and the wildlife and birds and everything. It's been really interesting to learn what we're lucky in terms of the government regulations, in terms of division for lots and things. It's pretty protected here, but it's constantly under threat. And there's more threat from developers up here cutting down trees and so forth. So it's important to me to learn, okay, you know, try and see both sides of it and present a reasoned argument to sort of do all I can to kind of protect what I love about living up here. And I think our generation has also really, really stuffed up in terms of trying to protect the environment. So whatever
didn't
little bits we can
job.
Do. No, and I hate, you know, looking, you know, at our children and really thinking what kind of legacy are we leaving them. We're leaving them with a mess. So if there's any little things that I can help in some minuscule way with, then I'm really happy to do that.
In the 70s and into the 80s, there was a phrase that was around, certainly in the areas that the people that I mix with, and I don't know whether it was a global saying or not, but it was think globally and act locally.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a really powerful statement, and yet we haven't seemed to have really acted on it all that well, though. But the very things you've said, we're lucky up here, we have in the Dandenongs, as you said, it's for all the things that are wrong, it's still fairly well been protected, although you can't let your guard down. But if you look Australia-wide broadly, and let alone the world-wide broadly, there seem to be a lot of people that are concerned, but not much is being done about it.
Yeah.
Whose responsibility is it?
Well, I think it is the responsibility of individuals to keep the pressure up on. A lot of this is under the control of politicians. So, I mean, I don't, obviously, I wish I had an answer. I don't. But I think that idea of think globally, act locally, it's very practical because it's overwhelming to think, what can I as one person, how can
I
stop the bleaching of the Great Barrier Reef or the melting of the ice caps sitting here in my dining room in Belgrave? I probably can't. I can do what I mentioned. You know, I can learn about what's around me and try and protect what's around me, and learn about what kind of threat it's under. But it's interesting because the think globally part, I think we've let that down a little bit, I think, because that's where it's failing. It's, you know, the pressure and the fact that politicians like Trump can say, well, I'm not going to sign these different accords to the climate accord and so forth. So I don't know what the answer is, Rob. I guess we just have to keep up.
It seems as though
so forth. It,
worldwide, and you mentioned Trump, and don't want to turn this into a political show, but in many ways our own government is no better off, because it seems to me that what their reaction is a very immediate thing to deal with what they see as important. Now, let's keep coal going because it keeps prices down.
Oh.
Let's not think about the reaction, what's going to be in 20 years' time.
Exactly, yeah.
Do you think young people have enough concern about this? Because it's the world we're leaving them and they're inheriting.
Yeah. Absolutely, I do. I absolutely think they do. I think there's still a huge groundswell of concern and activism from younger people that needs as much support as we can give them. I think they've turned it around to different things, like the rise in being a vegan, vegetarian, you know, in terms of that global impact, which is quite sensible. And that's become quite pervasive, you know, and it will have a big impact. And there, a lot of them are, it's animal rights reasons, but it's also the impact on the planet. So I think that's had an enormous groundswell of support, and I think it's also been largely driven by people under 30. So that's fantastic, I think, you know. And a lot of the people working locally, there are a number of fantastic young people too. In many cases, it's the gray-haired ones maybe have the time and they're leading it. But a lot of young people are really interested in it and interested in getting into environmental work as a profession and so forth. So I'm quite hopeful. And I guess we just have to find a way to keep these things in the political agenda and be really forward thinking, as you just said, you know, not just thinking about the next election, but what are going to be the implications in even 10 years if we don't.
Well, I guess as long as we can keep a dialogue going, there's a chance that things will change. It's if we stop talking about these things and just bury our heads.
Yeah, and I think as an older generation of that grew up with activism, if I can call it that, even from the most, you know, gathering names to petition to actually being out in the street activists, I think we need to remember that, you know, that our generations had a lot of privilege and we shouldn't forget that spirit of working for what we think is really important, whether social justice or environmental causes. We don't want to let down the next generations again by not being true to the principles that we had when we were in our 20s, I think.
Judy, I think that's a fantastic place for us to leave it. That's both a philosophical ending and I think a very heartfelt one. Thank you very much for being on the program.
Thank you, Rob, for the opportunity to tell some of my stories. I really appreciate it.
Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Wesley Mission Victoria. The program is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.